Beginning in the late 1870s, the federal government began to take Native American children from their families and put them into boarding schools, sometimes a long way away from the places that these children were born and grew up. The government believed, that it would help these children assimilate. And they dressed them in Western clothing, and they cut their hair, and they taught them in English, and they told them they could not speak their native languages. They did what they could to break the connections between these children and their cultures. This morning, we'll talk about the Indian schools with historian Brenda Child, who says that, interestingly enough, while these schools were designed to separate children from their families and their traditions and their very identities, that the parents and the children did indeed work hard to maintain contact. And in fact, she makes the argument that these schools might have, in some ways, helped to strengthen the very cultures that they were intended to weaken. She teaches courses in American Indian Studies and History at the University of Minnesota and has written quite a bit on this subject, including a book titled Boarding School Seasons, American Indian Families 1900 to 1940, published by the University of Nebraska Press, which was really the first study of the subject that made use of American Indian letters to document the experiences on both sides here, experiences of children and the experiences of their families. She also has been consultant to the Heard Museum in Phoenix for an exhibit called Remembering Our Indian School Days. She's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in the 6th Annual Graduate Symposium on Women's and Gender History. And we're pleased that she could be here and spend some time with us. Questions are welcome, as always. We just ask people who call to try to be brief so that we can get in as many callers as possible. But, of course, anybody's welcome to call. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
I'm happy to be here, David.
In this book, In Boarding School Seasons, you say something to the effect that your introduction to this subject, much like the introduction of other people, was hearing stories about the schools from a relative, and I think in this case it was your grandmother, who had been in one of these schools.
Right. Yeah, actually, most Native American people of my generation have grandparents or other older relatives in the family who were part of the who took part in the boarding school experience in one way or another. And actually, my grandmother had been a student in the 1920s at the Flandreau Indian Boarding School in South Dakota. And her father, my great-grandfather, was one of the first students from our reservation, which is Red Lake in northern Minnesota. We're Ojibwe. Mm-hmm. One of the first students to leave the reservation and attend the Carlisle School for Indians in Pennsylvania, which really was the first of the off-reservation boarding schools. Mm-hmm. And so I do have this family history, and I did first learn about boarding school from family members, from her conversations with her telling me about what it was like to be a kid, how she worked as a domestic servant as part of the school's outing program. And so that really is what inspired my research.
For how long did these boarding schools operate?
There actually are government boarding schools that still operate, but they're very different than they were in the 19th century. They were really kind of born out of this atmosphere of cultural assimilation. They're very connected to the land policies of the late 19th century, the time when the federal government was trying to convince Indians that they should give up communal property ownership and become, you know, citizens, Christians, become assimilated into the mainstream of American society. So we usually date the boarding school era from about 1879, when Carlisle was established, although there were earlier mission schools, of course, that worked with Indian people. And then I guess I tend to think of the kind of heyday of the government boarding school era being the late 19th and then the early 20th century. I talk about boarding school history up until 1940 in my book, because I see the Great Depression as being a very important factor in Native people attending the schools in kind of a later era. And then some of the schools continued. Many of them were closed down during the 1930s when the federal government actually moved away from the policy of assimilation and began to think that, well, maybe Indians should go to public schools, and perhaps removing young children from their families for extended periods of time was not a good idea. So some of the schools have continued through, managed to kind of stay operational past the 1930s, but really was just kind of a few schools that still exist, like the Santa Fe Indian School in New Mexico has its history as a government boarding school, but today it's operated by the All Pueblo Council. So it's, you know, very different than it was in its early history.
Hmm. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, as far as the government was concerned, what the intent was, because I'm certain that there were some people who would look at these schools and might be moved to use words like cultural genocide,
right.
It was a definite intended to destroy Native culture by taking children out of it.
Right.
And trying to break those connections. And while indeed that might have been the intention, I would imagine that people at the time would have thought that they had good intentions, that their idea was by taking Indian kids and making them more like other quote unquote mainstream Americans, mm-hmm. that was their idea of progress, that somehow
right.
that these children would be better off. So how do you assess mm-hmm. what it was that the people who started and organized these schools thought that they were doing?
Right. Well, I think there were people at the time who were very well-intentioned. I mean, politicians, reformers, missionaries. There was a great enthusiasm for this policy when it began in the 19th century. I think there were very few people who disagreed that this wasn't the best route, who would have, you know, I think there was a great deal of consensus around this policy in the late 19th century. So I do think some people were well-intentioned. The other issue, and I think, you know, one way to approach trying to understand this era is by looking at the land kind of policies of that time. Many people did think, you know, Indian people's ways of life were going to decline, that tribal people would not be able to kind of move into the next century if they weren't assimilated Americans. And you know, a whole number of people were convinced that tribal life was just going to be, you know, no more. And we know this was an era of, you know, great collecting and museums and, you know, that kind of thing. So, but, you know, the other issue about the land policies is really important to consider, because while people may have been convinced that, you know, Germans or other ethnic groups who came to the United States should have also assimilated into mainstream American society, why were there these unusual schools developed, you know, this whole system of kind of segregating Indians in off-reservation boarding schools in order for this to take place? And so I think we also have to keep in mind that the federal government was also very interested in the lands that tribal people were still in possession of in the late 19th and early 20th century. And we can't consider the boarding school era apart from the General Allotment Act of 1887, which sought to really reduce the size of Indian land holdings, make Indians individual property holders. And I know in the part of the country that I'm from, in the Great Lakes and in Minnesota, this policy had a very devastating impact on Native communities. Some communities in Minnesota lost over 90% of their tribal lands in this era. And so the boarding school policy really goes hand in hand with the General Allotment Act of 1887 and the land policies of the day. Now, people did say this is going to be in the best interest of Indians, but yet we have to realistically assess what those policies were, you know, at the time, and I think have a very critical view of some of the rhetoric of assimilation, citizenship, Christianity, or, you know, the famous phrase from this era was Colonel Pratt, who was the head of the Carlisle School, who said it was better to kill the Indian and save the man. Well, he was a very well-intentioned, many people at the time regarded him as a humanitarian educator. But obviously, you know, kill the Indian and save the man was obviously a very destructive policy for Indian children and their families, even though I think that they managed through incredible ways to be very resilient throughout mm-hmm. these years.
Well, just I have a couple of callers, and we'll get to them in just a moment. But to pick up on that last point, because I think that it's a very interesting one. Now, as you're saying, I think it seemed that the idea of the people who set up these schools, who took children from their families out of their cultures, sometimes sent them a long way away from home so they certainly couldn't go back and forth. And in some cases, children were away from their parents for years.
Yes.
That the idea was to try to foster in those children a new kind of identity so that they would no longer see themselves as Ojibwe or as Indians, but as Americans.
Right.
But what really happened, one of the things that happened was, as the children got to know one another, mm-hmm. it formed bonds that might not have formed otherwise, because it took children from different parts of the country, from right. different tribes, who right. likely would never have met one another otherwise, mm-hmm. And forged perhaps a new kind of identity that was tied more to being Indian rather than with their own people.
Ojibwe or Lakota.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think you make the argument that this may be where the roots of a kind of pan-Indianism mm-hmm. Might later, you can follow that down to the present time.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, if we're going to put a positive spin on the boarding school story, that this may be where Native people would kind of see it, mm-hmm. because many of us do think today that forging bonds with other tribal people, kind of coming together, even though in some ways under unfortunate circumstances, that this has been a very important strategy for Native people in the 20th century and the years, because they were dealing with so many of the same, not just social problems, political issues, federal policies. And so I think there were ties that were formed in the boarding schools. And I'm not trying to say that people didn't consider themselves Lakota, Navajo, Ojibwe after the boarding school years, but I think there has been, you know, a growing sensibility that we have issues in common, what historians have referred to as pan-Indianism. And, you know, you think about it, people kind of thrown together from across many different tribal groups. As you say, the idea was that children should be away from their homes or families for as many, often 4 or 5 years before they would see their families. And so children within these schools, I think they stayed in contact with their families and were very creative about it. But, you know, they did obviously forge very close bonds between, between students. Mm-hmm. And I think that was very important to their survival. And it has been, you know, an interesting kind of movement of the 20th century, even as Native people have, you know, urbanized and kind of come into closer contact with one another increasingly, I think, throughout the 20th century. And, you know, part of the philosophy of the schools was that kids should now speak English, right? That's a very important, essential part of it. And so now with the boarding school era, people have had, you know, this in common, right? That they were not separated any longer, perhaps in the same way as they were before, by culture, language, now geography within the boarding schools. And so, you know, that has had its benefits as well as its downsides, because we're also concerned, even, you know, here in the early 21st century, about the declining number of people who speak their tribal languages. So, yeah, there are always, complicated issues. Yeah.
We have as our guest here in this part of Focus 580, Brenda Child. She teaches courses in American Indian Studies and History at University of Minnesota, where she is Associate Professor of American Studies. And again, if you're interested in reading on this subject, one book that you might look at is her book, Boarding School Seasons, which talks about the experience and particularly uses letters that were written back and forth between children and their families to paint a picture of what life was like. It's published by the University of Nebraska Press. She's here visiting the campus and was good enough to come spend some time with us. We do have some callers ready to go, and why don't we bring them into the conversation, and we'll start with someone listening this morning in Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. I find this subject very interesting because I believe there was a similar program in Australia where Aborigine children were taken away from their parents. Am I right about that? I believe there was.
Yeah, it's really interesting, the sort of parallels to this policy, not just in it existed in the United States, certainly in Canada. New Zealand had a similar program for the indigenous peoples there, the Maoris. And in Australia, they've had a very, they have been, it's been a big issue in Australia in recent years surrounding the Sorry Day, which is that the federal government, or the government of Canada, or excuse me, Australia, for many years did pursue a policy of removing Aboriginal children from their families, often outright adopting them into white families.
A lot of times the Aboriginal parents never saw their children again.
Yes, that's true. And so in many ways, I think the effects and the legacy of this has been even more devastating in Australia. And the policy lasted longer, so that people in Australia tend to be younger. You know, many of them are people in their 40s now who were part of this policy of removing children from their families. And this story has become kind of more well-known in recent years because of the national conversation they've had in Australia about removing children. But also many people saw that wonderful film that came out, I think, maybe a couple
Rabbit
of years
Fence.
Ago. It's called Rabbit Proof Fence. Yeah, and I highly recommend that to everyone.
Well, as
it is.
Of fact, I saw it the other day. It's on the True Stories channel, and I believe I saw it and enjoyed it.
It's a kind of a drama, but it is based on the experiences of real Aboriginal children who were removed from their families and then returned to them hundreds of miles running away from the school in order to go back. So in Australia, sometimes children were removed for the purpose of education, but as you indicate, also outright adopting them into white families.
Well, you know, it's interesting. In Canada, when they tried to integrate the Cree Indians, it led to a tragedy. One of the Cree Indians was sexually violated and then murdered, and it took years for her to get justice. Her name was Helen Betty O'Connell.
Mm-hmm.
I believe they did a movie on it called Conspiracy of Silence. It was a true story. It took, 7 or 8 years before they finally brought the Canadian boys to justice, and only one of them was convicted. It's interesting that although they take these children out of the home, put them into the schools, and want them to dress white and act white, they never really let them assimilate into that society.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Let's go to a nearby community, Belgium, by Danville, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to bring into the topic the aspect that we're really doing an injustice here from the very beginning. You, me, and everybody refer to them as Indians. That's really a misnomer. We should call them by their real names, like Ojibwe and Lion Eye and all the various types we have. We never refer to them as what they really are from the very first day, and we do it still to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And even to the point that you call them tribes, and they were really more than tribes. They weren't really a nation, but they were much better organized group of individuals than just a tribe where everybody was related to everybody else.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so this goes on to this very day.
Right. Well, I appreciate your comments, and I know most of us who are Native people have different ways of kind of explaining our identity, and often we do refer to ourselves as Indians because that has just been, you know, something that we've grown accustomed to. But Indian people usually do have much more specific ways of explaining their own identity, especially when we meet other Native people, as I have been doing since I have been visiting the last day here at the University of Illinois, meeting some of the Indian students and graduate students and faculty members. And so we tend to be much more specific. And so when I meet people here, I usually identify myself as a member of, the Red Lake Ojibwe Nation from northern Minnesota.
Yes, and that's where we really do a total injustice to the people, because we can't refer to them as natives, because though I'm not a native, an Indian, if I want to use that word, I still am a Native American, because I've been here several generations.
Right.
Obviously, you've been here several more generations than we have.
Yeah.
But it's such a thing that goes on to this very day.
Right.
It's so sad. Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you.
Well, let's go to another caller. This is Champagne, and it's line number two. Hello.
How Kola, Lila Washte, South Dakota, Sitcha.
Greetings.
I taught on the reservations out there for all three of the major reservations. So I know quite a bit about what is going on there now, which I think is a lot more important than what went on years ago. And it's been my experience of where the reservation schools, now run by the Indians, are destroying their own children. And I've been into a lot of trouble over that. But I also have a couple of little stories that I wrote up on my website that may interest you. One of them deals with I knew quite a few of the old survivors of Custer's Last Stand, although none of them were white people, obviously. And I have a couple of other things that I could send to you, or you could visit with my website and see what you think of those.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, did you want to tell us what the website is?
Well, sure. It's www.merlyn, SCHUTTERLE.com. Okay. I have some other things that I would be, you know, some other interesting little stories that I've collected, especially about the guy that I wrote about, Harry Kingman. And I still know his relatives. And the first two little stories, you click under stories, and has a little article about Harry and one of his descendants that I had in school. And Harry's daughter got to be my godmother. So we're go back a long ways with the Lakota peoples. Mm-hmm. So I hope you enjoy that, and I'm heading back to South Dakota in 2 weeks.
Oh, lucky you.
Well, I don't know. I'm not all that popular. Seems like Governor Janko and I didn't get along too well. Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's go on again. We'll go to a caller here in Charleston. This will be line number 4. Hello.
Yes. I think this is relevant. In Rensselaer, Indiana, there is St. Joseph's College, a Catholic school, and across the street on the east side of the route there is what the locals refer to as the Old Indian School. Mm-hmm. And would you know anything about that, and or if the Catholic Church then participated in the process?
There were a number of mission schools that educated Indians before the government boarding schools were established and simultaneously. So there are a whole, it's a kind of story all itself, I think, the mission schools. And it isn't something, so I would not be surprised at all to hear that there was, you know, an Indian school in this area of Indiana. There certainly were Indian schools in the Midwest, in the upper Midwest, in, the Southwest, and pretty much all over the United States where there were native populations. So I would not be at all surprised to hear that. For the purposes of my own research, you know, as a historian, I tended to focus a little bit more on the federal boarding schools operated by the United States government. Just for the purpose, you know, sometimes when you're a historian and you're doing research, it's easier if you can kind of, you have to kind of narrow down the archives you're going to work with. So I didn't myself do research on the mission schools. Now in Canada, the federal government of Canada funded residential schools, funded missionary organizations to work with Indian communities. And in fact, the residential schools are very connected to the Episcopal Church, especially in Canada. And that tie was broken a little bit earlier in the United States, whereas the federal government did fund missionary organizations, the Episcopal Church or the Anglican Church, the Catholic Church, Presbyterians. There are a whole number of church organizations that did establish mission schools. And gosh, there's one memoir that I really like a lot. Well, a couple of them that I might mention. One is The Middle Five by Francis LaFleche, who was an Omaha man who attended a mission school in Nebraska in the 19th century. And his book, which talks about, recalls his experience and especially his close ties with his friends in that school, is really wonderful. Even though it was published around 1900, it's still in print by the University of Nebraska Press. And I often have my students read that. It's really a very beautiful memoir. Another one from Canada is Basil Johnston's Indian School Days. And he attended a Jesuit residential school in Ontario. And Basil Johnston's Ojibwe, he's an older man now, but was a student in the 1930s. And he tells the story of when he was a child, the Indian agent coming in to take he as well as his sister to residential school. And he says the sister that was supposed to go with him to school was sick, and so she couldn't go. And the agent was supposed to bring two kids into the school, so he arbitrarily took Basil Johnston's younger sister to school. So she was 4 years old. So he and his younger sister ended up in this school. And he mentions arriving there, the sort of trauma of arriving, and then not seeing his sister again for months because she was in the girls' school, and he couldn't see her or interact with her. despite the fact that the story sounds very sad, it's really a kind of a triumphant story in many ways, because he talks about the rebellion of students, the resistance of students, and it's actually a very funny memoir. And that's published more recently by, I think, the University of Oklahoma Press. And so those both deal with more the mission school story.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, again, our guest in this part of Focus Live Radio is Brenda Child. She is Associate Professor of American Studies at University of Minnesota. She's here visiting the campus to take part in the 6th Annual Graduate Symposium on Women's and Gender History. And she's written quite a bit on this subject. And again, if you're interested in reading, one of the books that you might look at is her own, which is titled Boarding School Seasons. And it is published by the University of Nebraska Press. One of the things that maybe sets this book apart a little bit from others is that you used letters that were written. People wrote to their children. The kids wrote back, talking about their experiences, what was going on with them at school. Also, parents tried to keep children aware of what was going on back home.
Well, when I started doing the research, one of the things that concerned me is that there had been very little work done prior to that time that focused on Native people's interpretations of the boarding school experience. We'd had books that talked about federal policy, reformers, educators like Pratt, but nothing really where Native people were telling their stories, other than in these wonderful memoirs and life histories that I have mentioned already. And so it was very important to me to try to locate documents. I was trained as a historian, so my first instinct was to go into archives. And I was sort of warned at the time that it would be very difficult to accomplish this because, you know, people said if you're going to go in the National Archives and do this kind of work, you're going to find documents, you know, mostly written by non-Indian people. The official correspondence with Washington, annual reports from the school and that sort of thing. And when I went and did the research, I found actually, you know, of course, I did run into a lot of that material. But as I was going through the boxes and boxes of materials in the National Archives from some of the former boarding schools, I began to find letters that Indian people wrote. And I found that the letters kind of logically divided into certain topics. And I really just organized the book around the letters. And I tried to, as much as possible, let the Indian people kind of speak for themselves. I found letters that my grandmother had written to the school in the 1920s. I found a letter that her great-grandfather had written to the school requesting that she come home for the summer. Their letters were not important, you know, historically in any particular way, but it was, of course, very meaningful to me. And it was the first time I'd seen my great-grandfather's handwriting. He had passed away before I was born. And so what I really like about the letters is it shows that even though, you know, Native people were part of these institutions and were, you know, had to kind of live through these very difficult years of forced assimilation and acculturation, what really inspired me was how families managed to stay in contact with one another, how children managed to, you know, stay connected to their families, their homes, their tribes, their communities. And if anything, I hope that's what the boarding school, my book, Boarding School Seasons, the story it tells. Because more than the history of any particular institution, I really look at it as the history of Indian families and communities, in particular, people from the upper Midwest, like my own people, the Ojibwe, and their experiences. So if I could just read you just one short letter to just give you an example of some of the letters that I found. This is actually a letter written in the later period during the Great Depression. And I was trying to understand why Indian families sent their kids to school, because obviously we know early in the boarding school era, it was about forced assimilation, compulsion. There were compulsory attendance laws passed, and Indians had no choice. In fact, they could be arrested if they did not send their children to government boarding schools. And there's a very well-known story out of the Southwest that I just mentioned in passing in the book, but it's about the story of Hopi people from Arizona, a group of whom spent time in the federal prison at Alcatraz because they did not send their children to school, Hopi men, during the assimilation years. And it's really kind of a stunning story, shocking in many ways. So I wanted to understand why in later years, if these were always controversial institutions with Indian people, why would anyone send their kid to a government boarding school? And I found that actually in the 30s, the Great Depression turned out to be a very important story. This was a time when many Native people had, in some cases, lost their land. Their traditional economy had declined in one way or another through a variety of circumstances. Some of them worked for wage labor at the time. And these were some of the first people here in the Great Lakes, anyway, where I'm from, who were unemployed. To be unemployed during the Depression. And so there actually were a lot of letters from parents asking to enroll their children in government boarding school. And let me just read you an excerpt for a short letter. This is from a father, a Wisconsin Ojibwe father. And he had been recently widowed, and he wrote to the superintendent of Flandreau, the boarding school in South Dakota, describing his situation, and I quote him. He says, "I've lost my wife and left me with six children. I would like to ask you to send these little folks over to you 2 or 3 years so I can get along. It is hard for me to stay here alone home because children not used home alone when mother gone. When I'm going working out, it is hard for them. And this is all I ask you, if you have a place for them." So I think it's very important to keep in mind this idea of family preservation in thinking about the later boarding school era because, you know, this man is not saying, you know, I want my son to become Christianize, speak English, learn a vocation, and assimilate into the mainstream of American society and play the piano or whatever, you know. He's describing a situation he's faced with. He has very few options. And so it's interesting to kind of think that early in the boarding school, these institutions started out as places, you know, what one historian has called weapons of assimilation. But in later years, they do become very familiar institutions to Indians. There were lots of Native people, thousands of Native people educated in these schools, like my grandparents, over the years. And so later, especially as policies kind of relaxed and administrators were more likely to send children home for summer and that sort of thing, in these years, sometimes Indian people did ask to enroll their children in boarding school, especially if they were experiencing hardship, which I think was the situation with my own grandparents. My grandfather was a single parent. His wife had passed away, and my grandmother ended up in boarding school during the 20s. And that was a very typical experience for students.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we have some other people here. We can bring them into the conversation. The next in line is someone listening this morning in Indiana. And line number 4, right here. Hello.
Hello. Two things. Earlier in the program, you mentioned that somebody or the government, you know, quote unquote, finally decided it wasn't really a sensible thing to pull children away from their families.
Right.
And I was wondering whether, you know, how that came about. Were there certain severe cases of mental illness or children just leaving the school and, you know, getting lost, trying to get back to their original land?
Right.
You know, was there a particular politician who said, you know, this is crazy, we've got to change this? That's the first question.
Right.
Second question deals with the missionary schools and what you've called the government boarding schools. I presume, of course, the mission schools came on heavy with Christianity. And I was wondering if in the government-supported boarding schools, whether, you know, you had to adopt Christianity or, you know, things were going to be pretty tough for you. I was sort of interested in that.
Right.
And I guess in some ways it's difficult. The fellow talked about earlier and about Rensselaer. I live close to Plymouth, and there was a forced march from Plymouth, Indiana, into Illinois. I think it was around 800 people were forced marched. Then when I was a graduate student down in North Carolina, I learned about the really difficult forced march that started in North Carolina out to the west. And these always...
You mean the removal era?
Yeah. Always bother me, and I just wanted to mention that so people
Thank you.
Think about that one.
Right. Well, I'll try to answer both of your questions, which are very excellent questions. I would say during kind of for most of the boarding school era that, you know, we tend to think of this idea, oh, there's a separation of church and state and so forth in our longer history in the United States. But actually, it probably wouldn't have been tremendously different to attend a mission school or a government off-reservation government boarding school. Christian church attendance was compulsory for Indians in the government boarding schools as well. So at this time, Native religions and worldviews were, you know, not tolerated. They were viewed as pagan, very much inside the boarding school, just as we know ritualistic dancing, ceremonial life, that kind of thing were being suppressed on Indian reservations. Certainly the same experience was true for children in the off-reservation boarding schools. The difference might be that they probably had a choice of religion. That is, if their families were, and some Indians were, in Minnesota, Catholic or Episcopal, by the time they attended government boarding schools, they could have their choice of which church services to attend. But attending church and, adopting anyway outward symbols of Christianity and attending church was very much a part of the boarding school experience. You asked if, who turned away from the policy of forced assimilation and so forth. And there is a figure who does kind of loom very large in discussions of policy during that era, and that is John Collier, who was Commissioner of Indian Affairs during the New Deal era. He was Roosevelt's Commissioner of Indian Affairs, FDR's Commissioner. And he was someone who was very opposed to the boarding schools. He would always refer to them as medieval institutions, and he called the people who ran the schools folks who lived in the Dark Ages. And so he was not an advocate of boarding schools. And he, I think not coincidentally, was someone who did also have a great appreciation for Native American religions. And he had interesting experiences, particularly in the Southwest with Pueblo people, that had really had a great impact on him. And he thought that there was, of course, much beauty and art in Native American life and culture, and thought it was certainly worth preserving, and that Native people had the right to do it. And so when he became Commissioner of Indian Affairs in the 30s, he began closing the schools down and argued for the very sensible alternative of public school education for Indian people. And so you start to see the kind of gradual move toward public school education for Indians in the 1930s. And one of the sort of ironic things about this was that, and there were funds that the government set aside for school districts in the United States to provide for the extra cost of educating Indian kids as they moved into public schools in the United States. Some states didn't do very well using the funds for the purpose they were intended, but the state that I'm from, Minnesota, actually was one of the states that was better at using these funds that we call the Johnson O'Malley funds. But the interesting thing is, when I was doing research for boarding school seasons, I found that there were still a lot of kids who wrote to the school in the aftermath of, in this era when they could go to public school, who were writing to superintendents asking to enroll in the Indian schools, finding that the security of that kind of all-Indian environment was something that they would rather do. I remember, actually, I don't know if I can find it quickly, but there was a letter in the book from a kid named Melvin from northern Minnesota. And he wrote to his superintendent saying, I want to come back to Flandreau. I'm the only Indian boy, and he underlined, at Park Rapids High School in Minnesota. I will tell you more when I get there. So obviously, the transition to public school was not something that always went easily or well for American Indians, just because there were funds set aside for it. And I think there's a whole interesting story there with the integration of Indians into public schools in the United States. Mm-hmm. So, and one of the allusions that you made to in your wonderful question too was about resistance. I mentioned John Collier and people in government because we tend to talk about their impact because they did make real changes in the 30s. But obviously, Indian people and their families had in various ways resisted these institutions as well. Kids ran away from school. Parents refused to send their children to schools. Sometimes they showed up at school to pick them up and bring them home. They were not sort of passive people throughout the boarding school era. And even though, I look at this as a very misguided policy in a number of ways, Native people, I think, were very creative at surviving the boarding school era and stayed in touch with their children, managed to stay connected as parents and children. And so I think we have to consider that important story as well.
Right. We have maybe about 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Brenda Child. She is Associate Professor of American Studies at University of Minnesota, where she teaches courses in American Indian Studies and History, has written on this subject in her book, Boarding School Seasons, American Indian Families, 1900 to 1940. It's published by the University of Nebraska Press. We have some other folks here. We'll try and see if we can get everybody in the time that remains. Our next caller is in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hello. I basically have a comment and a question. My comment is, wouldn't it be awfully traumatic for a child to be just put in school when they don't know the language or anything and just torn away from his family? And the second question I had is, what is being done now so that the various languages of Indians can be preserved?
Those are very good questions. I'm just writing them down so I don't forget. I think it was very traumatic for students when they first arrived at boarding school. On the cover of my book, which sadly you can't see, but I have a photograph that shows the youngest children who are enrolled at the Haskell Boarding School in Lawrence, Kansas. And there are over a dozen kids in this photo, and they're holding up a sign that says Haskell Babies, indicating that they are the kindergarten class. Well, you know, I have a four-year-old daughter at home and an older son, and I can't imagine separating for them for 4 or 5 years or easily giving them up. And you can imagine, you know, that it was a very, you know, traumatic experience for the kids themselves as well as for their parents. And what I see in the letters is that parents themselves were often expressing their, you know, their sadness, their despair, their unhappiness at being separated from their children. And actually, a lot of the day-to-day correspondence with the school is trying to convince superintendents that they be allowed to have their children come home for summer visits and that kind of thing, even in the era when, you know, the rationalization of the school in the early boarding school era was always, you know, that we can't send the kids home for the summer because it's going to undo all the good work that we've done during the course of the year. So it's a mistake to do that. But I think it was terribly traumatic for the parents. I think it was very traumatic for the children to be separated from their families. I have one chapter in the book that I call homesickness, and I really, in that chapter, just use letters in there where children and parents talk about how they're dealing with their separation. And I think, you know, it's difficult to, you know, understand the depths of despair some people must have experienced during this time. I'll just read you a real short letter. This is not from a kid, but it's from a parent who writes from a reservation in northern Minnesota to one of the schools where her son was in South Dakota. She says, "My son Charlie seemed to be discontented at the school, and what am I going to do about it? He's written to some friends here that he don't like it there, and if he feels that way, don't you suppose it's best for him to come home?" And the mother asks the school superintendent to speak kind to him and advise him to stay there and be a good boy, not to think about running away from school. Tell him I figured on him learning some trade while there, and I feel very much disappointed in him not liking the school. And there are lots of, I think, you know, ways that students expressed their unhappiness and loneliness. And I thought it was very important to have a chapter just called homesickness because it's such an important part of the boarding school story, as Native people indicated again and again in these letters. And even though historians don't always write about emotions or the history of emotions, I think it's a very important part, you know, of the boarding school story that is just, it would be a mistake to avoid it. I know I've done some, I was telling students that I met with here at the university yesterday about some workshops that I've done with elders. There were some elders up in Manitoba who had been residential school students who came down to Minnesota because they wanted to meet me, and we were trying to work out how to get together, and they couldn't come down to Minneapolis, and at the time I couldn't go up to their particular community in Manitoba. So we met in northern Minnesota, and we had a great weekend together where I talked about my work, and they testified and talked about what their experiences were as children. Many of them mentioned going off to school at 5 or 6, not knowing the language, as you indicate, and that just, you know, here they were, many of them 75, 80 years old, and it's still a bitter thing that they're still trying to get over, you know, as sort of senior citizens. And so it's a very sad part of the boarding school story. Regarding the language issue, you know, it's another kind of fascinating story. I think even though we do look at the boarding school era as contributing very much to the decline of tribal languages across North America, there has been a very important movement. I don't know if we would think if I could name a more kind of impressive and significant movement going on in Indian country today than the effort to revitalize and maintain our tribal languages. At the University of Minnesota, where I work, I'm a historian, but we do have colleagues who work and teach Dakota language, which is one of the Siouan, you know, languages, which is spoken in the southern part of the state by Dakota people there, many of whom were removed out of Minnesota in the 19th century, but there still are Dakota people and communities in Minnesota. And I think it's very important that we teach that language at the university because it's part of our state history. It's one of our state treasures. And then there are more people in Minnesota who speak the Ojibwe language, which is my, you know, tribal group. And we offer, you know, language study in Ojibwe. And we also have at our university one of the premier North American Indian Algonquian linguists in our department. So students can actually take, you know, courses in kind of like you'd say conversational Dakota and Ojibwe, and then they can get advanced language study as well, so that if they want to teach or develop curriculum, language planning work, that kind of thing, they can also, you know, do that at the university. And that's just one thing going on in our community. Of course, now one of the things that, you know, we all know that it's much better to learn a language when you're a little kid than when you're in college. I think many of us had that experience with Spanish or something, that we're not fluent in these languages that we studied in college. And so another really exciting movement in Indian country is the immersion schools that have been created. There's one in Wisconsin for Ojibwes that some of our graduates of the University of Minnesota have started. There's a really successful program in Browning, Montana, on the Blackfeet Reservation, where they now have little kids speaking Blackfeet in the community again. One of our graduate students at the University of Minnesota has been one of the leaders in Miami language revitalization, which hasn't been spoken by people since the 1960s. And through, they have a lot of historical documents that recorded the Miami language. And then through studying languages by people who speak similar languages like Kickapoo today, they've been able to work on revitalizing that language. And one of our students actually is from, what is the town? Kokomo, Indiana. Mm-hmm. And he he's just a young guy in his 20s, but he's a great language teacher, in addition to being talented in a number of ways. And so that's, to me, wow, that's really an exciting story. I mean, to think, you know, that this language is, you know, people talk about language death, and they say that their language was just, you know, sleeping, and now it's being revitalized. And I take a lot of encouragement from those movements going on in Indian country today. And I would say, you know, these are not just something going on, a movement in North America, but we've been very, there has been a lot of, cooperation between Indigenous peoples worldwide over this issue of language revitalization. Our department at the University of Minnesota has a very close relationship with Maori Studies, where they have revitalized the Maori language in New Zealand. And the Native Hawaiians have been very good in this work. And so some of the methods, and there's a lot of sharing that kind of goes on among language teachers and people active in this movement. And in fact, we're having a conference up on the Fond du Lac Reservation in early April. And if anyone's really interested in this topic, they could contact the Department of Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota and learn about this language conference, which is bringing together a lot of Dakota and Ojibwe people in Minnesota, but also other people from North America, Native Hawaiians, and there's even a Maori contingent coming from New Zealand. So it's better, you know, I like the strength in numbers thing going on with language. Thank you for that wonderful question.
Yeah, I appreciate the question of the caller. We're just so short on time, I think probably we're not going to be able to take any more callers, and my apologies. We just I only have so much time for an hour, and we can only do so much with it. I think that's it's really a fascinating story, and I think at the very least, it's good that now this is a story that seems to, through your books, and I know there are other people who have written about this, is a story that is being told, and people are seizing part of their history,
right,
and looking at it both for what was bad about it and what might possibly be good about it.
Right. And I would encourage any people, since we're still getting snow here in Illinois, if anyone wants to go to Phoenix, there's a wonderful exhibit called Remembering Our Indian School Days at the Heard Museum in Phoenix that will still be there for the next year, that explores, you know, the history of this policy in the United States and its impact on tribal communities. And so you can kind of, you know, read books. As we say, there's interesting films out there like Rabbit Proof Fence talking about Australia and museum exhibits. And I think it's a topic that, you know, has meant a lot to me because my family's history, but it's also one that we really need to know to understand more about the history of the United States.
Our guest, Brenda Child, she teaches courses in American Indian Studies and History at the University of Minnesota, where she's professor of American Studies. If you would like to read more on the subject, you can look for her book, Boarding School Seasons, American Indian Families 1900 to 1940. The University of Nebraska Press is the publisher on the book. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.